Welcome to NSL Unscripted, a national security law podcast, brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's The Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. We bring you conversations and hot topics from NSL practitioners today and hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to part two of Big Tech and Armed Conflict, a conversation held at the first Emerging Technologies in the Law course at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Part two will include the remainder of the conversation with the panelists, as well as questions fielded from the audience. We hope you enjoy this series.
I mean, we are spending a lot of time talking about big tech's responsibility, but I mean, as we know, for LOAC compliance, it's really on the states, right? And so, yes, we don't think maybe ethically, morally, or good business that they can just say, well, we don't have a part in this, right? But I guess I want to flip the question a little bit and ask you all, how can we as practitioners and the government work with private sector, big tech companies to improve our compliance with the law of armed conflict? What would be some advice, besides just replaying the soundbite that you just perfectly provided to all of us? But besides that, what other advice would you give to the practitioners out there that are trying to work on behalf of their client with the private sector?
Well, I think it's interesting. There's some cross-cutting tensions. Jonathan mentioned what's the impact of these companies calling me in the middle of the, no, what's the impact of these companies putting broader civilian infrastructure at risk and so on, and the call for public-private partnership in cyber to reduce the security risks that we have. There's arguments that say under Article 58, the passive precautions, et cetera, precautions against the effects of attacks, that public-private partnership to build resiliency of your cyber infrastructure overall is actually consistent with the law of armed conflict. But at the same time, the more you're doing that and the more the private sector is picking up a piece of that sort of civil defense, the natural risk and consequence of that is that the adversary may look at that and say, well, now I need to take them out, right? Because they're standing between me and my overall objectives. So there's some cross-cutting tensions. And there's also questions. A lot of it we've been focusing on, I'd say, like the micro-level risks of direct participation in hostilities, status of your infrastructure, and so on. There's a macro-level risk question, and that is under laws of state responsibility, under the practical aspect of how the other side's going to look at what's going on, are companies out there doing these things in an uncoordinated or synchronized way, or at least not in a way that the government's got knowledge of, and putting the United States at risk, right, of being dragged into something. So, there's questions of law of neutrality, there's questions of broader international law and due diligence that all swirl in the background of this. So I think there has to be a pretty robust dialogue so that everybody's on the same sheet of music and understands where the risks are and who is actually buying the risk for whom.
And I think that dialogue comment is, I think that on a lot of these new and frankly sometimes like really difficult questions, the most important thing is to start the dialogue. This is a good beginning. I think having, discussions between groups like ICRC, universities, companies, governments, policymakers is the right direction, right? Because, it is. We all come at this problem from wildly different perspectives. We just do. And there's what you're seeing now is only going to continue. The trend is only going to continue. It's probably going to deepen, frankly, right? Like it's just the nature of the use of technology, and it's the nature of conflict, right? That benign technology is both it's something that's beneficial, but it's also, it's either a threat or it can be turned into a weapon, right? And so, mundane things like your iPhone and an app that transmits targeting information, no one thought about that a couple of years ago. That would have been, no one was thinking about those kind of uses, but those are real things today. So I think having the discussion is really important. Helping companies see their role differently. I think the what I would describe as like the real cyber people that I work with, a lot of whom came from the government, have a pretty good sense of this. Like, they don't maybe talk about it the way we would hear, but their instincts are all there. I think the real target is the senior leadership of companies, where they just don't think about this, right? They get it, they could understand it, but it's not what they're thinking about every day, and there are significant implications of it. And I think the dialogue piece is what's missing and is important.
Jonathan, did you have some comments on this? And then after this, we're going to wrap up with a break so we can get some of the questions from our audience. But did you have any last comments on that?
I don't have a whole lot to add. I mean, I think the issue of dialogue and understanding of risk on both sides mm-hmm. is really important, meaning how government and how the ICRC and others understand how companies calculate risk, and then most certainly for companies to understand what they're getting into if they carry out any particular public-private partnership. And I think that's really where government lawyers come in, is being able to articulate not only what it means now in peacetime, or now doing purely civilian defensive sort of activities, but what it means if you build up a relationship that's going to get built out to do more, and what the expectations might be and what the risks are. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind, I think, and this is a little bit different than the corporate responsibility and human rights discussion, is that you're usually in that space also talking, in addition to what Matt said, about how companies don't want to do what would be equivalent to violations of human rights. That's not exactly what we're talking about here when it comes to risk. We're talking about governments carrying out what they're lawfully allowed to do under international humanitarian law, and risks emerging with those who they work with to carry out those activities, but also to, for example, civilians, customers of a company that are attached to the infrastructure that might become a military objective. So those are not necessarily risks in relation to we don't want to violate international humanitarian law. It is also a question of what are the risks if everyone complies with international humanitarian law, and the risks are nonetheless there for employees, property, civilian clients, et cetera.
Yeah, right, Gary.
Yeah, just quick on that point, and I'm talking to a room of judge advocates who I'm gonna assume know this and it'll resonate, but again, not naming names, Chatham House, but you know, there was somebody recently.
I think you have to say it three times.
Yes, then they appear, it's like Beetlejuice.
That's right.
Somebody was incensed when you talk about the app-based intel collection, right? Targeting information. Incensed that you could consider that to be direct participation in hostilities. You can't do that because everybody has a cell phone. Well, yeah, that may complicate the identification question. Can you identify somebody who's actually using the app for that purpose or the phone for that purpose at a given moment? We've been wrestling with the challenges and difficulties of how do you identify someone in DPHing. That's a rules of engagement question. That's, you know, you talk about advising clients. That's a very different angle to the question. But how do you manage that risk of being over-expansive or misidentifying targets, so to speak, because the nature of the environment is such that so many different people can be engaging. Yeah, you have to be really careful and manage that, but you don't change the rule to simply meet the difficulty. You know, that type of activity is DPH. So it's just a question of when and where you can invoke that rule.
Yeah, that's right. So thank you, gentlemen, for this first half of the panel and the podcast. And so with that, I'm going to break for about 5 minutes or so to give our audience a time for a comfort break. And if anyone had any questions for our panelists, my team will go around and collect those from you all. You can just pass them to the ends of the aisles, or the ends of your seats, and we'll collect them up. And then we'll go for another half hour or so when you come back answering some questions. Thanks. Okay, welcome back. After our break, we got a ton of questions up here. I have about 15 note cards, so I'm not going to get to everyone's questions, but we have a few that seem like they covered multiple note cards. So we're going to start. We have one for Matt specifically. And this question is, so what is your company's perspective on DoD's supply chain risk management imperative? Specifically, is a national security risk apparent, and is industry supportive or resistant to addressing it? Could you please discuss? Thank you.
Okay, how much time do we have? I meet frequently with the Defense Department's supply chain risk management leadership. So, like, I'm really familiar with this topic, and what I would say is, it's true, we welcome the U.S. government's efforts to regulate better cybersecurity. So that's the first thing. You'll see under the Executive Order 14028, there's a number of things that have come down. We've been very involved with the U.S. government, with CISA, with the Defense Department, and other agencies. NIST is the standard setter. We work very closely with them. I visited the White House to have this discussion, to sort of share our perspectives. So we are fully invested in what the U.S. government's trying to do to drive better security. And it comes, frankly, like there's some things that are pushing our limits in there too, right? Like it's not like, oh, it's easy for us to do it, so we support it. That's not the case. There are mountains of work and piles of money to be spent to make sure we do everything that we need to do, but we think it's the right thing. For us, it's the right thing for security generally, and so we support it 100%. I think that the one thing that we are mindful of is it's really easy to have like theater of cybersecurity. So like, you know, this is common in legislation, right? You can see it on display at hearings all the time. So what we work hard to do is make sure that the actual state of technology is well understood by the people writing the rules. And you would be surprised. Like, I met with the European Commission last week, and they're passing a giant comprehensive cybersecurity law as we speak. And we explained that, you know, a router, which you all have in your home, and it just transit, you know, the internet. Today, in the back room here, they've got a bunch of equipment. That router is, it's a router. It's a switch. There's a firewall that you can stick in and pull out. It's got security stuff built into it. There may be a threat intelligence feed that comes into that thing. It's digital threat intelligence, right, that has automated blocking of threats. Like, a router is not just a router. So when the government thinks of technology, they often think of it in a sort of, like, you know, sort of monolithic way. And the technology pace is moving so fast that it's hard for the government to keep pace and make sure they regulate in the right way. And that's why I think, you know, the U.S. government is doing a good job of being, you've got umbrella executive orders, and then you've got, like, very discrete buckets of work that need to be done. I actually think they're moving a little bit slow. And there's probably a need to speed it up, especially in light of the announcements that you all saw this week, which you could imagine are backed by years of analysis, right, to reach the conclusions that were discussed openly. So we absolutely support what the DoD is doing, what the government is doing. It is essential that we have good supply chains. The one thing I'll say is there's a tendency to look at China and things that are produced in China as like a boogeyman, okay? There are risks of producing things in China. It is a reality of the global supply chain that only some things can be obtained in China, okay? So our company has taken a proactive steps to distribute our supply chain, right, so that we can produce more things in more places. Like most companies, we all sprinted to China, you know, 20 years ago because it was cheap, it was easy, and it was efficient. And we're all having some version of redistributing our footprint. But there are things that you cannot get outside of China. Simple things like a power cord that powers your laptop, you cannot get that anywhere but China. Does it pose a cybersecurity risk? Theoretically, maybe, but really, probably not, right? So there are things for the government to worry about when it comes to China sourcing. Things that have processing built into them, that have intelligence built into them, right? But basic widgets that come out of China, that's more trade policy than it is cybersecurity policy. You've got to be real careful not to conflate the two, because politically it's very popular to slam those ideas together. But from a practical perspective, it doesn't really yield any benefit. So I would say all companies are experiencing a version of what I described, which is we're looking at what's happening in China, and we're nervous. We don't want to wake up one day and find out that we can't get chip supplies because China has blockaded Taiwan, right? So these are things that we've got to think about. But I would only caution, the one grain of salt is that, and I hear it all the time, is like, what is made in China, right? With this idea that like that cannot happen. That is going to continue to happen, and we just have to find ways to manage that risk effectively, and there are smart ways to do it, but you don't necessarily see those in policy. What I will say is when you get into the technical leadership of the DoD and places like that, they understand this issue really well, and they have the sophistication to be able to think through it. But on a surface level, there's a lot of politics on that question that aren't really good security.
Thanks, Matt. So I'm going to go on to our second card here. And I'll open this up to anyone. I think, although I might just start with Jonathan on it. So the question is non-military involvement in military-like activities really greater now than it was before, for example, French resistance in World War II? Or is it really just appearing that way because of increased information flow and new ways of joining the fray?
So I think this is a great question and sort of has a quantitative answer that I don't know the answer to. What I will say is that in addition to the really important examples that the person gave in the question, there's also a rule from Additional Protocol 1 and 2 that recognize that civilians participate in hostilities, because it says that if they directly participate in hostilities, they lose for such time as they do that their protection from attack. So I just put that down as a historical marker amongst many that this is an issue that has been part of the battlefield landscape and part of international humanitarian law for a very, very long time. I would say that the things that the ICRC considers most concerning about what we're seeing goes back to those issues that I mentioned in my opening presentation. It is that you have large numbers of civilians reliant on digital infrastructure for essential services, at the same time that you have civilians having more access points to be able to provide support at a geographic distance using different tools and capabilities than they had in the past. So yes, you had car factories turning into munition factories in World War II, and yes, you had civilians that have come and offered military contribution that qualifies as direct participation in hostilities, and you have the rule of levée en masse, which again recognizes that there's going to be, and there has been historically, civilian participation in hostilities. I think it's the way that the cyber environment can connect civilians to situations of armed conflict that raises alarms for both how they do that, what they know about the rules of international humanitarian law when they do that, how states can regulate that, and also there's the big question, which we haven't discussed, and there's probably not necessarily a need to, but it's obviously sort of bubbling up, is how different states interpret international humanitarian law as it applies to their use of cyber tools and capabilities in situations of armed conflict. So you take all of those things together, so it's not only sort of the quantitative question of is there more of it, it's mm-hmm. also happening in an environment where there's more uncertainty. And I think that's something that is of great concern to the International Committee of the Red Cross, and one of the reasons why dialogue, one of the reasons why legal clarity is something that we've been pressing for on this particular issue.
Okay. Did you have a thought on that, Gary? Or were you just laughing at the phone that just went off again?
Different, I think it was yours.
Different phone, different reaction. No. Well,
there's some sort of phone alert going off for all those listeners that's fine.
No, Jonathan hit it. It's a great question. I've started writing something on this topic where the title is going to be, Is John Burns on Your Payroll? John Burns, if you don't know the history of Gettysburg, there's a big statue celebrating him on day one, you know, 80-year-old magistrate or whatever in Gettysburg that sallies forth on the first day of the battle with his rusty musket and starts fighting with the Union forces. That is paradigmatic direct participation in hostilities. Today, John Burns can be sitting, in Rio de Janeiro and disrupting General Lee's ability to command and control through cyber operations. So, yeah, it's been happening forever in warfare, but it's happening in very globalized, diffused, broad ways that raise a lot of challenges.
Yeah, that's right. And Matt, anything else to add to that? I'm looking at our time and realizing that we probably just have time for any closing comments. So, Matt, I'll start with you.
Sure, thank you. Number one, I want to reiterate what I said earlier. Like, just being able to have the dialogue is really helpful, and I appreciate it. I particularly like being here with this audience. And thank you very much for putting this together, and thank you for starting all of this, Gary. I think that, all companies need to learn how our technology is being used and how it's being consumed by people in conflict zones. And most companies like ours don't think of these topics very, we just think we're making great tech and like everybody should love it, right? But companies are going to have to start grappling with the implications of how people use their technology in new ways. And I don't think that that is going to change. And what we need is dialogue. We need education. We need writing and thinking on this topic that helps us get into the right frame of mind. That said, I would say to you, most companies want to do the right thing. Really, they do. And we've got whole legal departments dedicated to trying to do the right thing. And so this is just a relatively new area, I think, for companies to think about. And it's not going to stop. The whole concept of digitization, which really like went crazy and took off over 10 years ago, is going to continue to accelerate. And with AI and quantum computing, it's just going to explode. And we haven't even talked about those topic areas. So what you're going to see is more reliance on technology, more reliance on companies that build big data models, more reliance on companies that can provide quantum computing capabilities or defense against quantum computing capabilities. And the future is sort of deeper ties into these issues, not shallower ties. So let's keep having the dialogue, and this has been a really great session. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Jonathan, over to you. Any last concluding thoughts?
Yeah, no, again, huge thanks for pulling this together and to the audience for being with us. I was just mentioning to Gary during the break that over the last 2 years, maybe a little longer, maybe a little bit less, this legal conversation, I think, has gotten more interesting, more sophisticated, more nuanced, and is really evolving into sort of the places that it should be evolving into. So there's a little more government, obviously, at the table, more of the private sector at the table. The ICRC remains deeply interested, the humanitarian sector deeply affected by how warring parties operate in and through cyberspace. So that's one point that I just wanted to make, and this is sort of a contribution to that evolving effort. The other is that the issue of the relationship between international humanitarian law and cyberspace, as many of you know, but many don't, is not just an abstract or theoretical conversation. It's becoming more and more operational every day, and when you bring in the actors that are part of that operational reality, you have a better outcome in terms of who's involved and what they understand and the different relationships that need to be built and strengthened. And then the final point, which is perhaps the most obvious one, but it also probably makes it the most important one that Madden mentions, that this is an issue that's just going to increase. The conversations, therefore, need to increase. The attention given to it need to increase. It's going to become more relevant, not less, by our estimation. And from the ICRC's perspective, as one that's deeply devoted to international humanitarian law and the protection of victims of armed conflict, the implications it has on a battlefield for civilians, for others protected during times of war, means that we're going to continue to want to have these conversations over and over again. So thanks for the opportunity. It was wonderful to be on the panel.
Well, thanks for being here, Jonathan. And Gary, over to you. Any concluding thoughts?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks to General Shanahan for being my promoter. No,
free propaganda.
Free propaganda. I think the DPH question is certainly not irrelevant, although I think perhaps maybe the risk is a bit overstated in some sense. Like, again, if you're right in that combat zone, it's a different flavor. I kind of don't think that, as nasty as Putin is, he's going to dedicate time, resources to go find someone in Redmond, Washington. Doesn't mean you shouldn't engage with it, but I think the broader interesting question is at a national policy level. You know, we used to have neutrality laws. We don't now. And international law does not obligate states to prevent a lot of this from happening. In fact, the law of neutrality actually would allow a good deal of this type of support across borders and other things from the private sector. What are the implications of that, though? That's going to grow and change over time, and that's more of a national policy level question that has to be thought about a lot more as you're having public-private partnership, as you're seeing this activity tick up, and the risks to dragging a country into a conflict potentially where it doesn't want to be.
Maybe not just a national policy conversation, but another podcast episode. All right. Well, with that, thank you to Matt, Jonathan, Gary for joining me here in Decker Auditorium today to close out our Emerging Technologies course. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your thoughts and your time. And with that, studio audience, could you please provide our panelists with a fantastic round of applause for their comments today.
This episode of NSL Unscripted was brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's The Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense or its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Our department also produces the Operational Law Handbook, accessible online. We hope you have enjoyed this episode and look forward to future episodes for NSL practitioners. Thank you.